That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Like a phoenix from the ashes, the electronic cigarette industry is rising fast. According to Wells Fargo, vaping rakes in an estimated $2.5 billion per year, and the trend is projected to reach $10 billion in the next 3 years. So what's driving the market? Addiction to nicotine? Marketing? A gateway for those looking to quit smoking? Well, it turns out it's not so simple. Leah Satilli wrote about the surprisingly complex vaping scene in an article for The Atlantic called The Right to Vape. And Leah Satilli, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
So I suppose we should get right into the lingo, because there is lingo, and some of this I didn't know anything about until I read your article. Now, the FDA refers to them as e-cigarettes. Does the vaping community use that same term?
You know, they do. I mean, I've heard people say e-cigs, or but people who smoke e-cigarettes generally call themselves vapers, and that's because what they're doing is they're using these battery powered devices that actually turn this e-juice, which has tobacco in it, into aerosol, and so that's turns into vapor essentially. So they call themselves vapers.
Now, when we hear about e-cigarettes, we think of the ones that they sell at gas stations and are designed, you know, to look like cigarettes. But they really run the gamut. How much do these devices differ in terms of size, specs, cost, that sort of thing?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's anything you can think of. I mean, there it goes from, like you said, the sort of they're called cigalikes, where they look like cigarettes. And those are generally manufactured by big tobacco companies, but they range all the way to, you know, reusable giant ones. They have ones that look like guitar pedals, ones that look like, I mean, cigars. They really do range in every sort of shape, size, cost. So as far as the ones that are cigalikes, those generally are cheaper and more disposable. But when people get really into vaping, as a lot of the people I wrote about are, they will spend up to $300 or $500 on some of the more premier devices, I guess.
And it sounds like, you know, especially once we get towards something that's custom, that looks like you mentioned, a guitar pedal, we're seeing people that are really trying to distance themselves from smoking and big tobacco and the, you know, the sort of cigarette image in general.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the people I chatted with for my story, I mean, they're actually offended by the fact that big tobacco would even try and get in on this, because what they see is that the vaping has helped them quit smoking, and that they feel like smoking was something that they were really marginalized because of, they were really ashamed of. And so now they've broken away from these addictions and they're vaping, but now with big tobacco getting in on it, they're kind of like, wait, no, you're not invited to this party. This is just for us.
Well, to get a better sense of how different the vaping community can sort of make it sound compared to cigarettes and tobacco, here's a clip of Rodney Jaraback. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's the founder of Five Ponds. Now, that's a company that manufactures high-end vapor liquid.
I think what differentiates Five Ponds as well is the fact that we only had five original flavors to start. We've got, you know, and we're only launching fives. We've got five more coming down the road, which slated right now as the mixology edition, where every one of those flavors will mimic a signature cocktail. Let's just say everything will have a subtle alcohol note.
Leah, he sounds like he's talking about wine. Is there like an artisanal aspect to this community?
You know, with Five Ponds, there definitely is, which was a big reason why I wanted to talk with them, because you see e-juice everywhere. I mean, in gas stations, you'll find, you know, candy apple or sour apple flavored e-juice.
And I guess we should clarify real quickly that e-juice is, well, what is e-juice?
Well, e-juice is it's a liquid that you put into your refillable cigarette. So It's a mix of propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin, and then there's also nicotine in it. And people can kind of mess with the percentage of nicotine that they're actually vaping. So some people do vape a 0% nicotine e-juice, which is interesting because that means that they're really just vaping nothing in a way. So to answer your question, yes, there with Five Ponds, there's definitely this kind of high-end cigar smoker type of e-juice that they're trying to make. And I know that Five Ponds has things like crisp mint with chocolate undertones and a vanilla finish, those sorts of that kind of language that they use to describe their flavors. But really everyone that I chatted with for my story talks about that this is sort of this great equalizer with vaping, that anybody can do it. And there's, you know, women in their 70s that do it. And there's really kids in their 20s that have never smoked cigarettes, but have actually pick up vaping for the first time.
Well, and that's, of course, an issue that I think a lot of people, especially on the medical side of this, would be concerned about, not wanting new people to pick up vaping who aren't even smoking cigarettes in the first place. But I want to move towards another subculture that you talked about. Now, this is something called cloud chasing. I guess maybe could you tell us what it is just briefly before I play you this clip?
Absolutely. I mean, and I'll be honest, cloud chasing was the reason that I did this story and then was surprised by what I uncovered. So on Instagram, you'll see lots of people posting these pictures of them blowing these absolutely ridiculously large clouds of vapor. And that's what cloud chasing is. It's sort of this competitive activity to blow the biggest clouds of vapor that you can. I was confused by it because I didn't really know what the point was. But then when I had someone describe it to me as sort of like, it's almost like beer bonging or shotgunning a beer, then it kind of made a little bit more sense. It's sort of this silly thing, I guess.
Okay, so we found a clip online. It's like cloud chasing 101. It's a guy basically explaining how to do it and how to modify your vaping equipment to do it as best as possible.
You see, the average vapers don't realize how much technique goes into cloud chasing. There is a lot of technique involved, to the point where it can be considered an art form.
So it sounds to me a little bit like he's really trying to legitimize this as, I guess, maybe a sport. But are some of these kinds of pro vaping, pro cloud chasing trends and even events, because there are competitive events where people cloud chase, is this hurting, I guess, the cause for people who just want to replace cigarettes with vapor, which may or may not be healthier, but probably is?
You know, that's the real question, I think, because on one hand, there are people who say that cloud chasing is sort of this really great community of people that are really accepting and they want to just kind of get together and blow these clouds and whatever. But for some of the folks I chatted with for my story, they definitely said, you know, this looks bad. We don't know if this stuff is, it has not been proven yet to be healthier than smoking. So for young folks to be picking it up and, you know, really taking in this massive amount of the substance that isn't approved by the FDA, it might actually end up putting further regulation on it in advance of the FDA figuring out if it's good or bad. I think it could be pretty bad for the industry.
So you mentioned that, you know, big tobacco is definitely trying to wade in on this market. But right now it seems like there's so many different manufacturers, there's so many different retailers of the e-juice, of the equipment that people use to vape. What's going to happen to these quote unquote little guys if big tobacco really gets in on the e-cigarette game in a big way?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that I think things could really, really change, because I think that it could end up becoming a very expensive industry to be a part of. From everything, like e-juice companies may need to make it so all of their products are in glass bottles, or every item that they have, they pay a certain amount for it to be licensed and everything. So I think if big tobacco really does get in on it, I think we're going to see the industry completely change.
Leah Sottile, thank you so much for explaining this really interesting sort of weird subculture for us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Leah
Leah Satilli wrote about the vaping scene in an article for The Atlantic, The Right to Vape. You'll find a link to her article and a video of cloud chasing on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from futuristic vaping machines to good old-fashioned radio. When Word of Mouth returns, we'll talk to one of the designers behind a device that will tug at your public media heartstrings, a single-station radio that broadcasts from a mason jar. First, a quick break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The humble radio we know today has a history that dates back to the 1890s, when Nikola Tesla first showed that the transmission of radio frequency could be used as means for communication. Those early radios transmitted signals and were instrumental devices for ships during the war. The 1930s ushered in the golden age of radio, with citizens crowding around large radio cabinets to listen to FDR give his fireside chats. These days, traditional radios are a little more like living dinosaurs, mostly relegated to cars, and even that ubiquity seems to be under attack from satellite radio stations and Wi-Fi-enabled vehicles. So who will be the savior of the simple yet still very useful radio? Well, perhaps our next guest. Spencer Wright is a product designer and co-creator of The Public Radio, not to be confused with public radio in general. His project was launched on Kickstarter last month and ends tonight at 10:41 p.m. Eastern Time. Spencer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, Taylor, how are you doing?
So what is the public radio?
The public radio is a single station pre-tuned radio that is housed in a mason jar. So when you purchase it from us, we ask you what your favorite station is. We tune the radio just to that station, and then it shows up to you, and there is no tuning dial at all, just a volume and power.
So if they want to change the station, you're crap out of luck.
We are offering some support for changing stations, but we're not highlighting that feature. The idea is, you know, most of us are committed to our local stations and we listen to them, you know, morning and evening, and it's part of our routine. And so retuning it is not a feature of the public radio.
Yeah. Why would anybody want to turn off New Hampshire Public Radio? Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So we live in a technological age where the radio does seem to be more of a choice than a necessity as it once was. And yet you have helped create an extremely simplified version of this classic radio. I guess my question is, why put it in a mason jar?
The mason jar, honestly, was kind of a mistake. Originally, we started out, we were kind of looking at making our own custom enclosure that would look something more like a piece of home audio equipment, you know, brushed aluminum and wood and that kind of thing. But as we were prototyping it, we just needed a container to put speakers in to compare them against each other. You know, when you're buying, when you're evaluating different speakers, you need to put them in some kind of a resonator to see how they sound.
Sure.
And we just grabbed a jar off the shelf to try that. And it worked well for the experiment. And then we kind of realized that it looked cute. And it was so easy to move forward in that direction and kind of make it a feature of the product rather than trying to improve upon it.
Now, does the jar itself act as an amplifier? Is it like the speaker itself?
Yeah, so the jar is the resonator for the speaker itself. And so in theory, you could swap out the jar that we ship the public radio with to something else with a different shape, and it would change the characteristics of the radio. It might make it more or less bassy, for instance. And so if you decide to, you know, go ahead and replace the small jar that we send with a larger jar, then we would imagine that your radio host with lower, deeper vocal cords would come across a little bit more sonorous.
Mm. You've definitely struck a chord. You've asked for $25,000. You've raised over $80,000. So if people miss out on the Kickstarter, it's ending tonight after all, where can they find the public radio in the future?
So we will be accepting additional pre-orders after our Kickstarter closes on our website, which is thepublicrad.io. It's spelled just like the public radio, but with a dot between the R-A-D and the I-O. We'll be selling those for the next couple of months before we go into production, and they'll be shipping in May. After that, we are really excited to get these things in the hands of local public radio stations to give away as fund drive gifts. We see them as kind of better than a tote bag, if you will. And we'll also be targeting a couple of kind of specialty retail stores as well.
Yeah, better than a tote bag. Them's fighting words.
Yeah. We love our tote bags too, but yeah.
Yeah, you've got to. Otherwise, how can you honestly be a public radio fan?
Exactly, yep.
You mentioned on your Kickstarter page that your project is subject to FCC testing, which is kind of amazing. It's this little very DIY-looking radio. What kind of tests do you have to pass to gain FCC approval for this thing?
So for electronic devices like this one, they put the device into an electromagnetic chamber, and they turn it on, and they see how much radiation comes off of it. Now, this is not like radioactive stuff. This is just radio waves, basically. So we're subject to that kind of thing for both the FCC in the U.S. and also CE in Europe. And both of those are pretty lengthy and expensive processes. And so the Kickstarter campaign is meant to help us defray some of those costs on the front end.
Spencer Wright is a product designer and co-creator of The Public Radio, which was launched on Kickstarter last month, ends tonight at 10:41 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find a link to the Kickstarter at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Public radio tends to work under the assumption that people are, on the whole, good. We fundraise on the honor system, we believe that people want to be informed, all that good stuff. But it is hard to deny the power of humanity's darker elements. In this piece originally produced for Philosophy Talk, Natalie Jones examines the lasting pop culture power of history's most Machiavellian teacher, which would be, of course, Machiavelli himself.
Niccolo Machiavelli has inspired how-to books for business leaders, mafia bosses, and parents. He's inspired a graphic novel and a comic book, and even an MS-DOS video game. You can take a psychology test to assess your level of Machiavellianism, how willing you are to use deception and thievery to advance your own cause. But it's people fascinated by power that really seem to be captivated by Machiavelli.
You know, most of the guys that I know, they read Prince Machiavelli. And I had Carmela go and get the Cliff Notes once, and he's okay.
Tony Soprano preferred The Art of War by Sun Tzu, but other mobsters have taken valuable lessons from the prince. In the 1993 movie A Bronx Tale, a mafia boss explains Machiavelli to a protege.
Is it better to be loved or feared?
It's a good question. It's nice to be both, but it's very difficult. But if I had my choice, I would rather be feared.
But what might be the most surprising homage to the philosopher is a posthumous album from the rapper Tupac Shakur called The 7-Day Theory, where Tupac takes on the alter ego Machiavelli.
Tupac wasn't just a rapper, but he was also a poet, playwright, actor, and as the character Machiavelli, I wanted to imagine himself as not just an artist, but also as a philosopher or educator.
Travis Gosa teaches African American studies at Cornell University. He spends a couple of days on Tupac every year in a class he teaches on hip-hop. Gosa says while Tupac became known for embracing a thug life ethos, he didn't start out with that message. I hear Brenda's got a baby, but Brenda's barely got a brain. A damn shame, the girl can hardly spell her name. That's not our problem, that's up to Brenda's family. Well, let me show you how it affects our whole community.
While he was born on the East Coast, once he became a West Coast artist, he found that very few people were interested in his black power, socially conscious lyrics.
Tupac was a big reader all his life, but it's widely believed he studied Machiavelli seriously when he was in prison in 1995, serving time for sexual assault.
Tupac was intelligent to use a book that is not only a classic philosophical treatise, but a book that many individuals who have been incarcerated may be familiar with.
Tupac was released from prison in late 1995 and recorded The 7-Day Theory the next year. He was shot and killed in Las Vegas in September 1996. The album was released after his death and became a big success, hitting number one on the Billboard charts. The song that maybe most mirrors Machiavelli's teachings is called Blasphemy.
Tupac on this track is asking whether or not it's better to be loved or feared and how to avoid being hated. And he actually comes up with the ideas that, you know, pretty much people are going to hate you no matter what, right? So don't be too concerned with being hated.
And then there's advice for being on your guard. Watch for phonies, keep your enemies
close, watch your homies. Tupac is painting a very dark and grim image of human nature. He believes in many ways that the downfall of a leader, of a ruler, will come from within.
To this day, conspiracy theorists and fans pore over the album and compare notes with Machiavelli's work for clues about Tupac's death and signs that he might still be alive. For example, Machiavelli wrote about strategically spreading rumors about the deaths of prominent people, and some made the leap to the idea that Tupac faked his own death. It doesn't appear that the actual Tupac will be coming back, but Travis Gosa says we can take some messages from the album.
Tupac Shakur, in the use of Machiavelli, seemed to be trying to signal a rebirth of Tupac. And the death of Tupac signaled a rebirth of Tupac that would be focused on trying to use the music to spread something beyond gangster entertainment.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Pumpkin-scented candles, pumpkin-flavored lattes, pumpkin-infused vodka. Yep, it's October, when word of mouth continues, a sampling of the best and the worst pumpkin-spiced beers. Stay with us.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. As far as we can tell, there isn't a single seasonal flavoring as ubiquitous as the wave of pumpkin-spiced food and drink that descends on grocery stores every fall. Pies, coffees, yogurt, bagels, pasta, potato chips, vodka, whatever the product, chances are some company or another has slapped on an orange label and made a pumpkin version. Among the worst offenders is the beer industry, where it seems like just about every brewery has now succumbed to consumer demand and jumped on the pumpkin spice bandwagon. Josh Jackson is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Paste Magazine, where Jim Varel is news editor. Together, they have made sampling these seasonal brews a tradition, and they published their fourth annual list of the best and worst pumpkin ales earlier this month. Josh, Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hello there.
So the first pumpkin-flavored beer I remember having was Shipyard's Pumpkinhead Ale, which my brother introduced me to, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. When did this trend really get started? Josh?
Well, there's been pumpkin beers a lot longer than there's probably been pumpkin yogurts or pumpkin vodkas. It's a long-standing tradition with beer makers, but I would say about 5 years ago it really seemed to explode.
Overall, what kind of changes have you seen since you started sampling, you know, a few years ago?
Well, I think the variety is really what you're seeing. You're seeing so many different approaches to the beer. You know, it used to be people would take their pale ale or their wheat beer and add some pumpkin spices to it. Now you're seeing pumpkin imperial stouts and, you know, all kinds of pumpkin sours and all kinds of crazy varieties. But really, in general, there's two ways to approach a pumpkin beer, and that is, one is to add a lot of actual pumpkin flavor, which is almost the rare way.
Yeah.
So many pumpkin beers are really fall spice beers, and they're just loaded with nutmeg and cinnamon.
Okay, so let's start off. For this year, you looked at 47 separate pumpkin beers. Let's start off with the worst contenders. Which are some of these beers that we should be avoiding at all costs?
Well, it's funny because what are the worst to me were the very sweet, almost syrupy pumpkin beers that are also very beloved beers among some pumpkin beer lovers. So if you read our comments, the fact that we chose Southern Tier's Warlock Imperial Pumpkin Stout as our worst beer is completely ridiculous, according to many who love overpowering pumpkin flavor in their beer.
And I'm looking at this on the website now. It looks like somebody took a Guinness and put black food coloring in it. It's so dark. And the description, your verdict, says, it's like taking an offensive beer and stirring in a mixture of Nestle's Quick liquefied black licorice in whatever form of tar they use to pave blacktops.
Those are Jim's words.
I may have written that. Yes, that was my hands down worst.
There's a few that just taste like you melted candy corn and just mixed it into the beer.
So, what are some of the best pumpkin beers that you thought didn't overdo it, that were, you know, really subtle?
Well, in terms of subtle or easier drinking ones, I really like that New Belgium Pump Kick, number 4 on the list. Light of body, you know, crisp, actually kind of refreshing, which is almost something you never say in describing a pumpkin beer. You know, something that I could actually see drinking with, like, a meal.
The Cigar City Good Gourd out of Tampa, Florida. There's nothing subtle about that beer, but the sweetness is coming from the malt, so it's like a good, strong stout in that way. And the pumpkin was more the vegetable nature of a pumpkin coming through than the candy version of that. So that one, and then Samuel Adams has a Fat Jack Double Pumpkin, which is an imperial stout with pumpkin in it. And it's just a hint of pumpkin with some, you know, good traditional spices in there that makes it not your average pumpkin beer.
Well, I was actually going to say that, you know, a lot of the beers that you featured here, they're not the sort of thing you'll find at your average grocery store. So would that be maybe the best beer from a brand that's pretty well distributed across the country, do you think?
It all just depends where you're at in the country. I mean, if you're out on the West Coast, it's not going to be any problem getting your 21st Amendment on this list or Uinta. But from a national distribution standpoint, you can at least count on being able to probably get the Samuel Adams or the New Belgium or the, you know, the big guys.
So Josh, are you a fan of pumpkin beers, or was this like an exercise in torture?
I am a fan of good pumpkin beers. There's several on this list that if it's October and I'm at a pub and they have it on draft, I'll be very glad to sort of embrace the spirit of fall. But there are few beers worse to me than a bad pumpkin beer.
And Jim, what about you? I'm wondering, was there any of these beers that were so different from the rest that they hardly even could be considered a pumpkin beer? You know, they stand out because it's different, not because it's good or bad.
That definitely comes into play. Number 5, the Timmermans Pumpkin Lambic, stood out because it was on this list the only pumpkin sour.
I don't know about that.
it actually brought a really refreshing change of pace to it.
Josh, we've seen a real explosion in the hard cider market, definitely the past few years, and I'm wondering, is there any chance that ciders or whatever, some other seasonal trend, might one day overthrow the reign of pumpkin spice? Could something else become the fall seasonal beer, do you think?
Well, what's funny is that there's a new trend in pumpkin cider. So even ciders are falling prey to the pumpkin spice.
Josh Jackson is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Paste Magazine. Jim Varell is news editor at Paste. You can find their complete list of the best and worst pumpkin beers this year at wordofmouthradio.org. Initially, we thought it would be pretty funny to make a list of the weirdest pumpkin-flavored products on the market for our website. We then realized that virtually everything has a seasonal pumpkin version nowadays, so it might be more challenging to find foods that have yet to be pumpkin spicified. So we compiled a list of mouth-watering possibilities like pumpkin spice beef jerky, pumpkin popsicles, or pumpsicles, as we've been calling them, General Tso's pumpkin chicken, and my favorite, pumpkin spice pickles. You can check out that list and share your own repulsive pumpkin products on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Well, if you think pumpkin spice beef jerky sounds odd, how about gumdrop bread? The triumphs and tribulations of locally produced, independently published cookbooks. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. A quick glance at Amazon's list of top-selling cookbooks reveals a strong focus on particular food trends and diets, like vegetarian-only books or recipes for the paleo tribe, or they bank on high-profile TV personalities like the Barefoot Contessa or Anthony Bourdain. These big, glossy cookbooks filled with mouthwatering photos are the norm nowadays, but in the 1970s and 80s, there was another kind of less appetizing but very charming alternative, the locally produced community cookbook. Meg Favreau writes the Forgotten Foods column for the online magazine Table Matters. She's amassed a small collection of these locally produced cookbooks, including a couple from New Hampshire's North Country, where she grew up, and she joins us now for more. Hi, Meg.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So how much do these books differ in terms of format and polish? How do they look different from the coffee table-sized cookbooks of today?
Well, almost all of the ones I have are spiral-bound. They're either typewritten or, in one case, printed on what appears to be a very old dot matrix printer. Many of them are illustrated with images. Like, for example, I have a page open right now from the Shelburne Sampler 2 that has what might either be a molded salad or a bundt cake or I don't know what on the page, and there's no context as to what it might be.
And the picture, so we're not talking about these like beautifully photographed, perfect food concoctions.
Right.
We're talking about like a sketch by someone who isn't an artist by trade.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned the Shelburne Sampler too. What's the story behind this one?
Well, this is actually a cookbook from my hometown. And I believe that, like many of these local cookbooks, it was made as a fundraiser. And so they invited everybody in town to submit recipes, and then they compiled them and sold them. And actually, the last time I was in New Hampshire this summer, this cookbook is still for sale in stores in the area, which made me really happy to see.
So Shelburne Sampler 2, what are some of the most memorable recipes from here that I'm hoping you've tried?
Well, my absolute favorite recipe is one called Eggless Applesauce Squares. It's great because I will reluctantly admit that I don't generally have a high opinion of vegan baked goods. This Eggless Applesauce Squares recipe is my favorite vegan cake of all time.
Wow. And this is long before the, you know, sort of the vegan trend really, really came up.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's not, it doesn't boast that it's vegan or anything like that, but it's just a really wonderful simple snack cake recipe that you can dress up or down.
Okay, so what about on the other side then? Do we see some really gross recipes?
Oh, yes. Oh, totally. So two of my least favorites that I will admit I have not tried from the Shelburne Sampler. One is cream cheese cabbage. And that's pretty much what it says with the addition of a quarter teaspoon of celery seed. And then there's also dockside zippy pineapple salad, which, first of all, there are literally no docks anywhere in this town, so I feel like maybe that should be a warning sign. Let me list you some ingredients here. We have your lemon jello.
Got it.
We have your lime jello.
Check.
We have your evaporated milk.
Gotta have it.
Cottage cheese.
Good.
Mayonnaise.
Hmm.
Crushed pineapple.
Yeah, it's getting a little weird.
Wait for the zippy. Horseradish.
and there's your zippy. We have another cookbook in your collection, Our Favorite Recipes, North Country Senior Meals. What's the story behind this one?
Well, this is another fundraiser cookbook, and it's, let's see here. So North Country Senior Meals would like to express our sincere appreciation to the many people who gave so generously of their time and energy in collecting and submitting recipes. Some of the recipes are treasured family keepsakes, and some are new. However, they all reflect the love of good cooking. I think that's a lie.
What makes you say that?
Because the soup, salads, and sauces section begins with a hot fudge sauce.
Oh.
But there's just so many. Oh, one of the – there's – so with this – with many of these local cookbooks, one of the things that I really love about them is that they're great places to find comfort food recipes, right?
Sure. And
your really good classic cakes, your classic casseroles, things like that. But this – I feel bad saying this because this is the area where I'm from and I love it dearly. But I don't know what is wrong with some of the people who submitted recipes to this. Because I look at macaroni and cheese pan casserole and I'm like, great, this is going to be a classic mac and cheese. It's going to be baked. It's going to be delicious. I'm going to read you a few ingredients again, if I may.
Oh, go ahead.
You begin with one box of macaroni and cheese dinner.
Okay.
So we're not doing the homemade mac and cheese. There's no real cheese in this.
The recipe includes the box.
Right. Package of frozen peas. Okay, that's common for old casseroles. Then one 12-ounce can of Spam.
All right.
A can of cream of celery soup or cream of mushroom soup. And then a second can of Spam.
You know, does anybody still make these locally produced community cookbooks? Like, why did this trend go out of vogue?
You know, I think that people do still make them, and you can find them occasionally, but it's just – it's so – as lovingly crafted as something like this might be, it's hard to compete with the internet where when you want a recipe, you just go online and you search for exactly what you want, and there it is. And I think that, you know, it's also spoiled people in terms of when we get a recipe, we want to know what it looks like. We want to be able to envision it. We want to taste it with our eyes, if you'll forgive the kind of cliche phrase. Poorly illustrated dot matrix cookbook does not quite stand up to that, although I assume nobody would use a dot matrix printer to make one these days.
Right. Well, we do often talk about the importance of the local food movement. I was wondering, maybe it makes sense to see a revival of locally produced cookbooks that actually focus on eating regionally available foods instead of things like Spam and multiple flavors of Jell-O.
Yes, that would be lovely, and that's a great idea. You should take that idea and run with it immediately after this interview.
All right, sounds good. Meg, thank you so much for sharing these little bits of forgotten food history with us.
Thank you so much, Taylor. It was a pleasure to be here.
Meg Favreau is a contributor to the online magazine Table Matters. You can get a link to her article and see some of the delicious and not-so-delicious recipes from her North Country cookbook collection. It's all at wordofmouthradio.org. And now we move to a dark corner of America's past and how cuisine changed as a result. After Pearl Harbor, about 120,000 Japanese Americans were uprooted and forced to live for years in remote federal camps around the country. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki Da Silva and Davia Nelson, explore the impact of internment on Japanese cooking and culture in America in a story they call Weenie Royale.
My name is Akemi Tamaribuchi, and I'm third-generation Japanese-American. During World War II, my family was interned in Tule Lake internment camp. I'm positive that so many of the dishes that I grew up eating stemmed from what they had in camp and how they incorporated that into their tastes. Fried bologna with a little sugar and a little soy sauce on top. Hot dogs and everything. They use things like ketchup and hot water for soup bases. We eat ketchup on everything. Weenie Royale and Hamburger Royale, they're my favorites. Sunday mornings we always had sliced hot dogs mixed with eggs with soy sauce and a little oyster sauce, stir-fried in with some onions over rice.
My father was Ito Ikemoto. Everybody called him Ed. He made that his official name after the war. He was a grocer. He had three grocery stores, and he lost them all, of course. My name's Howard Ikemoto. After the war, a lot of the Japanese came back to places like Sacramento. They had no jobs, and a lot of them got pickup trucks and became gardeners. When I was 12 years old, I would go every Saturday to work with my father. Every lunch, all the Japanese gardeners would meet in front of people that they were mowing lawns for. We used to eat rice with one plum in the middle, and then maybe have a slice of Spam, corned beef hash out of a can. That was part of our main diet in camp. And while they were having their lunch, they would talk about the camps, which was the prime of their life.
My name is Tammy Takahashi. I'm a native of San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley in the 30s, the depths of depression. I lived my whole life here, except for the 4 years of World War II. Everybody, if they had a drop of Japanese blood, 1/16, we were all gathered up and put into camps. Our camp, Topaz, each person was given a tin pie plate that held our meals. Even now, 70 years later, if I look at a tin pie plate, it brings back memories.
My name is Moss Kawaguchi. I'm 79 years old. When I was evacuated, they sent me over to Tamfram Racetrack. I had to live in a stable 6 months. You could still see the hairs on the floor, and you could still smell the horses. They told us that you're supposed to bring your own mess gear. Being a Boy Scout, I knew what to bring. They had a big hall. All 8,000 of us had to march in there with your mess gear in hand.
You lined up for your food and then sat down at these long tables and ate there. Everybody squeezed in where they could.
just broke apart the family because the kids were running around. There was no family dinner.
Somebody else was cooking your dinner. It wasn't your mother. That part of the family life was just institutionalized. My name is Jean Wilkotsky Houston. I was 7 years old. We went to Manzanar. It was bleak, desert.
The cook in our mess hall and Block 11 was a Coast Guard military cook, a grizzly old cranky guy, not very friendly disposed to the idea of children and women. It was determined that only children from birth to 12 years of age would be given 6 ounces of milk, maximum. And I was pregnant, but he wouldn't give me any milk.
We were very unused to eating potatoes. It was not something that was part of our regular diet. My father and mother ate rice every day of their life. Rice is certainly a soul food for Japanese Americans.
They had dirt floors in the barracks. My great-grandmother would dig a hole and ferment her own rice wine or sake and store it buried in the dirt. That was a big secret that wasn't allowed in the camps.
Every block had sake makers. Everybody had any connection with the mess hall. They scrape all the rice off the bottom of the pan and they'll make sake. My name is Jim Yamaichi. I spent 3 years in Tui Lake. You see that concrete thing over there? There used to be a guard tower in that corner. That's the slaughterhouse where they slaughtered the hogs, rendering the fat. The soap was made right there and took into the mess hall. It's where the chicken coop used to be. Tui Lake was one of the biggest farm camps. We supplied most of all the vegetables to other camps. 3,800 acres of farmland. Internees did the farming. You bring a carload of hot dogs and come in by the tons. And we eat hot dogs for days, you know.
My father decided he was going to have a family dinner at Christmas time, and he was going around the camp bragging to his friends that he was going to have a goose for Christmas. Everybody was mocking him. There was no place to cook a goose, and then where are you going to get a goose anyway, right? Tule Lake is a flyway for Canadian geese. So he dug this trench and laid down, put some gunny sack over himself, and put feed in the trench. And sure enough, the geese came down, and their wings were trapped. My father threw the gunny sack onto the geese. Every barrack had this potbelly stove, and he actually roasted it in there, and we had our Christmas goose.
My name is Shosei Hanayama, minister of Watson Buddhist Temple. After World War II in Yokohama, so many Americans came, Army and Navy, and they brought, you know, a hot dog. It's an American cuisine, you know, every year, Independence Day. They have a contest in New York City. Japanese young guy, you know, every year he ate over 50 hot dogs he ate in a couple of minutes.
This year's Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Takiro Kobayashi hoping to swallow the competition.
He'll show us a couple different looks. Right now he's Japanese-ing and solid-ing. He's breaking the dog in half, separating dog from bun. Still the man to be beat. He is the Lance Armstrong of our...
Some of my closest friends never even heard of the fact that the Japanese were interned. And there's so many things that have affected our culture, at least that came out of there, like the food. To be honest, I think that the Japanese culture is very silent. Nobody ever complains or talks about any bad times. And my grandmother, my oba-chan, she's 85 years old. Now she has all of a sudden become far more sensitive to wanting all of her family to understand where everything came from. You know, we lost so much of it. It's just like, call all the grandkids and Bachan's making weenie royale for breakfast. Come spend time so that you learn how to make this food so you can make it for your children and their children.
That story was brought to us by the Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki DeSilva and Davia Nelson, and mixed by Jim M.C. Key. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke with food writer Meg Favreau about the nostalgic world of community cookbooks. And we'd love to hear from you. Is there an old Granite State recipe you'd like to share with the public radio community? Do you have any locally produced cookbooks, complete with illustrations and dot matrix printed pages, still on the shelf? Share them with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the most fascinating recipes tend to travel by word of mouth. Virginia Prescott will be back in Word of Mouth's driver's seat tomorrow at 2. So join us then, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.